It's Wisconsin Today. Now, high-tech data centers, they're springing up all over the country, but one proposed for northwestern Wisconsin is on pause for now.
In Menominee, plans for a $1.6 billion data center are on hold after a draft memo from the city's mayor to the company behind the proposal saying the city's no longer interested in pursuing those plans.
Here is Menominee alderperson Cody Gentz speaking on our program last week about the passionate response he's seen from local residents.
But it is very, you know, inspiring to see folks getting more engaged with local politics. You know, seeing a packed audience room is quite amazing when I'm used to seeing in just a handful of folks.
To learn more about the situation in Menominee, we have its mayor, Randy Kanak. Mayor Kanak, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Wow, good morning. And with WPR Wisconsin, it's fun to be here with you folks. Menominee, Wisconsin, it's a beautiful day in Menominee, Wisconsin.
Thank you. And you said you drafted the proposed hold on the data center project after hearing concerns from constituents. Can you describe what you've been hearing?
Well, yes, I can. You know, the data center thing hit the public, and the public decided that maybe they wanted to step back and take a hard look at the data center. And they reached out to me, and there's quite a rally behind no data center in Menominee, Wisconsin. So that being said, people were contacting me, and I was listening to the general public on what to do next. You know, when the data center comes to Menominee, or when the representatives give their sales pitch, it's a pretty good sales pitch. You know, we can do this, we can do that, and it sounds really good on the surface. But then when you start digging deeper into it, at what cost to the community? And I think that's the biggest concern of the residents is, yeah, there's some good things that can come from a data center, but at what cost to the community?
Hmm. And some residents have opposed the secretive nature of the project coming forward, not knowing the tech company involved, the non-disclosure agreements, you know, working through a shell company. Is that lack of visibility a valid concern?
Well, you know, the general public, unless they're paying attention with the postings in the newspapers and that type of thing, they don't always hear about what's happening at City Hall, which is unfortunate. And we just recently hired a gal to be in charge of media releases for the city. And so we're going to try harder to put those that information out there to the public. But basically, you know, NDRs and NDAs and things of that nature are pretty common business, you know, for cities and general business as it is. But there is a concern that more of the community members wanted to know more about this data center. And so we are trying to be as forthright as possible to let the community know what's going on at City Hall. But it's a challenge because, you know, you post things out and not everybody reads those postings. So that being said, the community now is rallying on Facebook and multimedia and on all of those entities. And so there is a quite a scuttle, you might say, saying, hey, we need to know more about this and what's really going on. So it's kind of interesting how involved the community gets once they know that there's something that might concern them.
Yeah, the Stop the Menominee Data Center now has nearly 9,000 members for that Facebook group. That's like over half the population of your city. Turning to stopping this proposal, on what authority as mayor are you able to put the project on hold?
Sure. Well, as chief executive officer of the city, I have the determining factor what is good or indifferent or bad for the city. I do praise my city council, though. I have an amazing group of city council members. They were involved in the same sales pitch that I listened to. And, you know, when you hear the sales pitch from the data center representatives, it's really good. But then when you hear the other side coming back from the community, oh, now is it as good as it appears? Or maybe we should take a step back and a fresh look at this. So that being said, I offered a pause on this. I don't know if it's a long pause or a short pause or if it'll go away or what will really happen. But I did have that ability, and I don't hold anything against any of our city council members or the people selling the land. I think everybody is open to their own opinion. And also, we all try to do the very best we can with the information we have at hand.
But one alderperson, Sydney Brennan, thought you made this call unilaterally. Let's listen from the council meeting.
There once was a time in the city that the president of the council and the vice president had a say. I think it's ridiculous. I just have no words, but ridiculous, clearly, because it just is. There's no reason that one person should control the entire agenda for the city and the way it moves forward.
So, Mayor, where does the city council fit in plans for the project if it comes back online as a possibility?
Well, we would definitely listen to the city council. I know Sydney's new on the council for about 5 months now, and I know she has her own ideas and so forth on how things should operate. But we've had this discussion years ago with the council about having more individuals set the agenda and so forth. But that is the job and the duty of the mayor. And if anybody wants something put on the agenda, we would do our best to fulfill their needs. So timing is a little bit important on agenda setting. We don't want to have one meeting that's 5, 6 hours long and the next meeting have it be 20 minutes long. But I honor her thoughts. If she
And
wants to pursue something, we would definitely take a look at it.
I want to jump in here very quickly. Do you think the people behind the data center proposal will walk away from this, or will they come back with a different offer?
Well, I'm not 100% sure. It's kind of the ball's in their park at this time. As the mayor, I thought it was best to listen to the community. I kind of separated out Randy Kanak, my personal feelings from the mayor's feelings early on. The Randy Kanak in me doesn't think a data center is good at all, but I was willing to listen.
And we're gonna have to leave it there. Mayor Kanak, thank you for joining us.
All right, you have a wonderful day. Thank you.
You too. Randy Kanak is mayor of Menominee in Dunn County.
Coming up, the soybean harvest in Wisconsin could break records this fall, but the Trump administration's trade war is putting the crop in limbo.
Exported more soybeans to China than the rest of the world combined. To make up such a large volume, basically that's impossible.
Hear from a Janesville soybean farmer on WPR News.
Now, Wisconsin farmers are beginning to harvest their soybeans, but they're uncertain about where the crop is going to go.
Historically, the state exports most of the $1.3 billion of soybeans it grows each year, but tariffs and lack of international trade deals leave farmers without a clear buyer for this year's crop.
China is the world's largest soybean importer, but so far this year, the country is refusing to buy them from the U.S. because of the ongoing trade war with the Trump administration.
We're checking in on how Wisconsin soybean farmers are navigating this decline in demand while the costs of farming continue to rise.
Doug Rebout is a Janesville farmer and president of the Wisconsin Soybean Association. Doug, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
This latest USDA report is showing higher than expected soybean yields this fall. What are you seeing as the harvest comes in?
We have not started harvest yet on our farm, but just looking at the fields and walking through them, we're going to have some really good yields this year. I don't know if it'll be record yields, but it's going to be right up there close.
So, Wisconsin farmers were planning to plant fewer acres of soybeans this year with costs increasing. We've got the tariff concerns looming, we'll talk about. Has that been the case on your farm and from other soybean farmers you've talked to, fewer acres?
Well, our farm, we still planted the same, and there might have been a little change around our area. I mean, a lot of the farmers I talked to did not change a lot. But Wisconsin statistics this year, there was 250,000 less acres of soybeans planted in the state than there was in 2024. So there was some significant change.
So as the harvest comes in, Do farmers already have an idea of where those crops are going to go once they're harvested? Or, you know, where along in the process does a farmer actually line up the sale of their harvest?
Well, I mean, majority of farmers are just selling to local elevators. So we sell to the local elevators, and then they're the ones that are selling it and, you know, sending it down the Mississippi River or taking it to the Illinois River or sending it out on rail. So for farmers, there's not a lot of change. You know, we sell to the elevators, and then they're the ones selling to companies that are shipping it around the world or to crush plants and stuff like that. So the, you know, for majority of farmers, the end use, where it goes is not such a big issue. It's just that price that, you know, without the end user taking as much, that's where it's affecting the farmers, is on the price.
What are you hearing from the elevators on tariffs and disruptions with China specifically?
Well, you know, they're just finding, you know, hard places to sell it to. You know, with those markets kind of shrinking, there's less of a demand. So the elevators are in some of the same situations as we are on the farms, going, well, I don't want to sell these soybeans at a loss, because, you know, they're in a business just like the farmers, and they need to make their money too. So right now, you know, it's just that uncertainty all the way across the board.
How disruptive is this, you know, with tariffs and trade disputes? How disruptive is that for Wisconsin soybean farmers?
Well, it's a major disruption for us, because historically, 2/3 of the soybeans that we grow in Wisconsin get exported. And so when you have a market the size of China that all of a sudden stops buying from us, and China has always, we've exported more soybeans to China than the rest of the world combined.
Wow.
So when you take that big market and all of a sudden just shut it off, yeah, you know, the U.S. is sitting here going, okay, we have all these soybeans now, and yeah, we're working on opening up new markets to different countries, but to make up such a large volume, that's impossible.
So it's not like you can just turn to other markets and lay the groundwork for other markets to replace what China is, because China is such a huge buyer.
Right. Yeah. China's a huge buyer. And, you know, we can go and talk to these countries, and like the Wisconsin Department of Ag, DADCAP, they're going around talking to different countries about, you know, trade of Wisconsin products. The federal government is working on different markets, and we can get into these new countries, but it takes a while to build up the infrastructures. It's not like, okay, yep, boom, you're going to buy soybeans, we'll just load up a ship and take it to you. You got to make sure that whole infrastructure, from the time you load up that ship till the time it gets there, where are they going to, you know, unload it, and all that stuff. So all this takes time and a lot of patience on both ends. So yeah, these are not markets that we can all of a sudden just turn around and say, okay, China, you're not buying from us, so we're going to turn around and sell to Eastern Europe, European countries. It's just not that easy.
We have Janesville farmer Doug Rebout with us, president of the Wisconsin Soybean Association, as we look at the market for soybean farms in light of the impact of tariffs and trade disputes. Doug, why are soybeans then more impacted by these tariffs and trade disputes than other crops? Is that right?
Yeah, soybeans are the biggest impacted crop, you know, because soybean has so many uses. And just the fact that China is such a huge buyer of soybeans, where the corn is going, you know, spread out more to different countries. And so with China being such a big buyer of soybeans, that's one of the main reasons that China's or that soybeans are so impacted. It's because of that Chinese market.
What kind of capacity do farmers or the elevator, you know, typically have to store the soybeans that can't be sold right away?
Well, I mean, it's a product that you can fill up all your storage that you have and, you know, fill up every nook and cranny, but you want that gone by next year's harvest. So it's a product that has to get turned over within a year so you can make room for next year's. So you can't hold it year after year. I mean, I suppose if you wanted to keep building bins and investing, but then eventually, you know, you can only build so much and you can only hold it so long because, you know, you got bills to pay. You got to pay the, you know, the elevators have to pay the farmers for those beans. So they don't want to hold it in their elevators. Farmers, we can build more bins on our farms and store it and wait for better prices. But, you know, no one knows when that's going to be. And we've got our own bills to pay. You know, like right now, we're starting to look at the 26 crop year and we're starting to look at prices for our fertilizer and nitrogen and, you know, seed and everything. So this money that we're going to be collecting this fall from selling our crop, we're already looking at investing that back into next year's crop. So we need that money so we can, you know, pay for next year.
Well, let's talk a little bit about those input costs and what you're seeing in terms of the prices of, you know, what goes into running the farm. How costly is it for a farmer right now to grow soybeans?
Well, I mean, soybeans luckily are not as costly of a crop to put in as, say, corn.
Okay.
Corn needs a lot more nitrogen and a lot more, you know, the seed is more expensive for corn. All the inputs, all your fertilizer and nitrogen and everything, phosphate, that you need a lot more for corn than you do for the soybeans. So, we're not as reliant, but still, there's still quite a bit of, you know, fertilizer that we have to buy that is not made here in the U.S. that we have to put on our soybean crops. So we're buying, you know, potash and, you know, these products are coming from, you know, Canada and Russia and Ukraine that, okay, there's tariffs on all those. So those tariffs, you know, they're not being paid by those governments. They're being, those costs are getting passed down to us. And so, you know, we're kind of stuck in the middle. We're getting paid less for our soybeans that we're selling, but we're paying more for the products to grow those soybeans, more for the parts, you know, with all the tariffs. If, you know, if we want to put up a new bin, that steel is more expensive. So we're stuck in the middle and there's not a lot that we can do about it.
So as we wrap up here, how much optimism do you have that the federal government will be able to work something out here, work out a trade deal or some other solution for farmers?
I got to be honest, right now, there's not a lot of optimism, you know, maybe in the long run, but I do not see any short-term quick fixes that's going to help us because, okay, China's, you know, they quit buying from us. They're buying from South America. Even if right now we said, you know what, we'll take all tariffs off the table. Let's just go back to, you know, those open markets. China's got that relationship built up with Argentina and Brazil. They're not just going to turn around and say, oh, the U.S. is back in the market, so we're going to go back to them. It's a relationship that, you know, we would have to build back up, and that could take 10, 15, 20 years to build those relationships back up. So, like I said, down the road, yeah, there's always that possibility. And as a farmer, I have to keep that optimism that things are going to get better, but it's going to be a long game for that to happen.
Doug, thanks for the insights. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
That is Janesville farmer Doug Rebout, president of the Wisconsin Soybean Association. He was with us to discuss the impacts of tariffs on soybean demand and rising costs for farmers with harvests getting underway here in Wisconsin. If you're a farmer or involved in exporting a product, reach out to us. We want to learn about how tariffs are affecting your line of work. Have you made changes? Are you still sending or receiving products from overseas? Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up, from orchards to farmers markets to your local grocery, it's apple season in Wisconsin, and a restaurant owner and apple fan brings us recipes and advice for cooking desserts and dinners.
And the plethora of like different types of apples and different things you can do with apples, it just kind of always blows my mind every year.
That's next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's apple season. I was just at an apple orchard the other day. There was a lot of variety to choose from.
The latest fruit monitoring report from UW-Madison is out. Many parts of the state are reporting great harvests, but northeastern Wisconsin hasn't done as well after a cool spring.
If you end up coming home from an orchard with a massive haul of apples, like I did, the next question is, what do we do with them all? Apart from, you know, eating them.
A cafe owner and apple fan joins us with recipes for cooking with apples and to make the case that even unattractive apples can be good food.
Laurel Burleson is owner of Ugly Apple Cafe and is using her skills to promote waste reduction and local agriculture in Dane County. Laurel, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I know at Ugly Apple Cafe, you do a lot more than apples, but is there something about apple season that you get excited about, having this abundance of local apples to work with?
I mean, definitely. So we called it the ugly apple because it's kind of one of those great examples of like this time of year, there's so many apples and you have to do kind of anything with them to keep, you know, using them so they don't go to waste. So, I mean, just the abundance and the plethora of like different types of apples and different things you can do with apples is just kind of always blows my mind every year.
And the ugly part of this, I know a big part of your work is trying to cut back on food waste. Why is it important that even if it's not a pretty apple or insert other produce here, we still find a good use for it?
Well, the farmers, especially in Wisconsin, work, I mean, all farmers everywhere, I'm sure, work very hard. But I personally have met so many farmers in Wisconsin, and I know how hard they work every day making these products that are delicious and nutritious, and for anything to get thrown away just because it's not aesthetically perfect is just outrageous. Like, these foods need to be appreciated and enjoyed in whatever form they come.
What other kinds of things, we'll get into recipes in a bit, what other kinds of things do you like to do with apples apart from just eating them?
Well, there's lots of cool things you can do with apples. One that I really like to do and have done a lot kind of for the later season apples is making apple marmalade. That is kind of like shredding apples and preserving them kind of in sugar so that they keep their structure. It's kind of like the opposite of making apple sauce, but we also make a lot of applesauce and apple butter too. That's a good way to use like a lot of them all at once if you end up with too many, like a big bushel of apples. But then I also really like to bake with apples and kind of celebrate kind of the sweet and savory nature of them, like pairing them not just in pies and fritters, but also with like onions and winter squash and kind of appreciating the sweet savory mix.
You mentioned that apple butter. You've provided us a recipe along with a couple others. We'll have them up at WPR.org. What goes into making apple butter?
Very basically, you make applesauce. So just cook down your apples and blend them up. And then you take that applesauce and cook it extremely slowly, either in a slow cooker or in the oven. You can do it on the stove too. It gets a little dangerous. It can be easy to burn. But you just cook it down, 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 down until it's really just like dark and rich and more more closely resembling like a peanut butter than applesauce. And from there, you can kind of put in whatever little spices you want, cinnamon, ginger, nutmeg, bay leaf, anything kind of in that realm. You just have to be careful because whatever you start with in the big batch will get super concentrated and reduced in your end product.
And then what goes on to happen with apple butter? What do you like to do with it?
Well, for us, we put some in our apple cider donuts that we do for Door Creek Orchard, True Coffee Roasters, and we have at the farmer's market right now. But it's delicious even just on its own. I like pairing it with like some cheddar cheese and some crackers, or you can, you know, make a peanut butter apple sandwich with it. Those are the popular ones in my house.
It is apple season. We're talking to Laurel Burleson, owner of Ugly Apple Cafe in Dane County, getting great advice on using our abundance of apples this time of year. Laurel, I want to talk about a variety of apples. We've got a lot of great choices from sweet to tart and crunchy and soft and things like that. How important is it to match up the right kind of apple for the use? And I'll ask for some specifics in a minute, but do we want to make sure we're picking the right apple for the right job?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, especially when you want a texture that will match. You want something that's going to be like firm and hold up a little bit more dense if you're baking with it, because otherwise you're going to end up with, you know, apple pie soup rather than a nice apple pie with some structure. And same thing, like, you know, I have 5-year-old twin boys and they love apples, but like I have to be careful not to give them one that's too tart, because then they'll, you know, they'll get nervous. They'll get scared away at five. They make strong impressions of things if they don't like them right off the bat. So I got to make sure they're a little sweeter for my guys. But yeah, I think for some apples, you can kind of use kind of a broad range or do some experimenting or do a few different types in a pie or in a recipe like that. But then you definitely want to make sure texturally and sweetness wise, I would say that you're choosing kind of the right apple for the job.
Well, with applesauce, that, hey, maybe we're going to make it into apple butter later. Is that one where we want to be fussy about apples, or can we kind of mix and match?
I like to mix and match, I think, especially because the apple season starts really early some years. You can get kind of the first season apples in July, and they don't hold very long, and they're very juicy, so they break down really easy, but they are very tart. So I like to kind of get some of those and make them into applesauce and freeze them. And then when I have other sweeter varieties later, I mix them and then reduce that all down into butter.
Here's a hot topic for me right now. I was just at an orchard and my wife and I were thinking, okay, we want to do a flatbread pizza with apple slices like some cool pizza places have. But yeah, we don't want one that's going to be mushy. Do you have varieties that you would suggest for that's going to hold up on pizza and keep some of that crunch?
Yeah. Well, one of my favorites, and I'm trying to remember now if I got it from which orchard I got it from. I think it was Blue Roof, but I think Liz also has them at Door Creek right now, or not right now, but soon, is Great Northern Greening. It's like a tart. It's a giant apple. It's a little bit tart, and it holds up really nicely in baked goods. Like, it's kind of my favorite one to do like an apple tart with, or I used some in apple fritters last year. I don't think they're coming in maybe quite yet, but maybe pretty soon. And so I feel like it's kind of like a Granny Smith, but with like more flavor and a little sweeter and bigger. They're really big. I also like some of the russets for that. They maybe aren't quite as dense, but russet apples, they're called that because they're kind of brown on the outside. So they fit as like the perfect, like ugly apple. And they hold up pretty well. And they just have a really nice, complex flavor of like sweet, tart, tangy kind of mix.
In the savory world, another recipe you shared with us, pork chops with apple, bacon, cabbage. I like the sound of that. Tell us a little bit about this recipe.
Yeah, it's really fun for the fall, even into the winter, really. I feel like I've done a variation on this even for the holidays, like a pork roast. And you can kind of use any kind of variety of apple that's like a little bit tart, and it's okay if it kind of breaks down and blends in because the cabbage is going to maintain its structure. So if the onions and apples kind of melt away into like a delicious sauce, it's just fine. But also if you end up with some apple pieces, then it's a nice little surprise, like a little sweetness. And so I feel like you can kind of mix and match and figure out what you like best. Do a little experimentation.
That sounds fantastic. Laurel, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Laurel Burleson is the owner of Ugly Apple Cafe in Dane County. You can find her at the Monona Farmers Market and selling inside the Dane County Courthouse and the City County Building. In peak apple season, the local chef joined us to share recipes. We've got a few of those going to go up on WPR.org, and what she loves about reducing food waste and cooking with apples. Wisconsin Today producers include Royce Podeswa, Lauren Cox, and Mackenzie Crummy.
Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for listening to WPR News.